From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Doctor Is In. I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Joel, clear up a common misconception for us, all right? SWR. I hate when people call it SWR, but at any rate, that's just me. Many hams, unfortunately, think that it's a simple ratio of forward to reflected power, and that's not true, is it?
Oh, it's not true at all. And it's at the same time both complicated and simple.
Isn't everything?
Yes, I think that's true. Yeah, that's the fundamental SWR stands for standing wave ratio. And what it comes down to is it's a transmission line phenomenon. If you have a transmission line that's matched at its termination with its characteristic impedance, so a 50-ohm dummy load on the end of a piece of coax, for example, the voltage along the coax at any place along the coax will be essentially the same. It's slightly less as it goes along because of loss, but essentially the same independent of distance from the transmitter end. If the load is not matched to the characteristic impedance, the voltage will be different at different places along the line. The standing wave ratio is just the ratio of the maximum voltage to the minimum voltage on the line. Oven by itself, that's not too dramatic, except that it has a few effects. One is the impedance looking into the line at the transmitter end is not going to be the same as either what's at the load or the characteristic impedance. It's going to be a different impedance that's a function of the load and the length of the line in between. So the impedance actually transforms on the line. I thought it was going to be simple and complex. I guess I haven't found the simple part yet.
No, I'm waiting for that. Cutting to the chase, okay? Yeah. Why should I care?
Well, there are a couple of reasons you should care. The most fundamental reason you should care is if the standing wave ratio is too high, and by too high for most radios, that's about a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, most HF transceivers will tend to fold back or reduce their power output to avoid damage due to high current or high voltage in the final stage. As I mentioned, the voltage varies, and it can be that the current in the output transistors ends up being higher than it's supposed to be, and that could damage the radio. So the radio is smart enough to say, whoops, the load is not matched well, so I'm going to reduce power. And the problem with that is, of course, if the power is reduced from 100 watts to 25 watts, you won't have as strong a signal as you would otherwise have. So that's one thing. The other thing that happens is that higher standing wave ratio generally implies higher loss in the transmission line. And it can get somewhat dramatic. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But the way it manifests itself is as if there were a reflected signal, a reflected wave from the termination. And this is what confuses some people. If you send out a signal on a transmission line that's not matched, some of the power that's received by the load will be reflected back towards the transmitter. Some people think that's power that's lost.
Yes, but that's potentially a confusing point.
Yes, and that makes a lot of people worry more than they necessarily need to about standing wave ratio. Not that, you know, it's never bad to have a good standing wave ratio, but it's not as big a thing as a lot of people think. So what happens to that reflected power is when it gets back to the transmitter end, where there's usually an antenna tuner, it gets re-reflected back towards the radio. So it's not lost at all. So as a numerical example, if we had a 100-watt radio feeding 100 feet of, let's say, RG8X coax cable on 20 meters to a matched load, 1-to-1 SWR, 50-ohm load, we would have a loss of 1.3 decibels in that line, or lose 74, or we'd have 74 watts reach the antenna. So that means 26 watts is dissipated as heat in the transmission line on its way. It goes along.
You've lost a precious 26 watts.
Yeah. Yes. But 1.3 dB, to put it in perspective, is about a fourth of a S unit.
So you don't really notice.
Probably won't notice. I mean, there will be times if you're in moon bounce work, that makes a big difference.
Yes.
But for most of us, that won't be too noticeable. And how bad does the loss get? Well, let's say the standing wave ratio is 2-to-1 instead of 1-to-1. The loss will go up to 1.5 decibels.
Oh.
So a little more, Now we have 71 watts going to the antenna, and that's a loss of 29. Again, quarter of an S unit.
Mm-hmm.
I have an example that I'm going to discuss about a 2.6 to 1 SWR. And in that case, it's a 1.7 decibel loss, 68 watts to the antenna, losing 32. Again, not too dramatic. What about 10 to 1?
Oh.
Now, that gets pretty serious.
Yes.
And in fact, the loss there will be 4 decibels, more than half your power. You'll get 40 watts to the antenna, 60 watts heating up the transmission line. And by the way, the transmission lines can get quite hot. I've burned myself on RG8X in unscheduled experiments at times. So that's starting to get to be a problem. Now, it's important to note that this is all at 20 meters. At 2 meters, the loss is a lot higher. At 80 meters, it's considerably lower for all the same numbers. And, of course, if it's twice as long, it's twice as much loss. If it's half as long, it's half as much. So this all depends on exactly what you have. But 100 feet is kind of a typical distance, and 14 megahertz or 20 meters is sort of in the middle of the HF range. So I thought those would be good numbers.
Yes.
Now, if you are driving 100 watts to your antenna tuner, and the antenna has a 2.6 to 1 SWR before you tune it, it might shut down the transmitter somewhat in terms of how much power it puts out because it mm-hmm. might start folding back. So now you tune your antenna tuner so that it sees a SWR of 1 to 1 at the transmitter, and you will be putting out 100 watts again into your tuner.
Into the tuner. Right.
On the other side of the tuner, you still have that same mismatch.
That's right.
And you will still have that same loss in the coax, even though it looks very nice at the transmitter. The transmitter's very happy. You're happy. But you're still warming up your coax a little bit. And in terms of the power, what happens is if you had a power meter on the output of your antenna tuner, you don't usually do that.
Mm-hmm.
Normally you have it on the input so you can tune it for a one-to-one match. But if you had a forward and reflected power meter at the output of the antenna tuner, it would show that you have 125 watts forward power and 25 watts of reflected power. So you see what's happening here. The net power delivered to the antenna is the forward power minus the reflected power. So yes, 25 watts is being reflected, but 125 watts is going towards the antenna. So the net power going towards the antenna is the difference, 125 minus 25, your same original 100 watts.
Yes.
So your 100-watt transmitter is still putting 100 watts to the antenna. The only thing you lose is that 1.7 decibels of loss instead of 1.3 decibels if it were matched. So that's mm-hmm. the consequences of having the SWR. Now, I wrote an article about this, which people have...
You're rattling your paper.
Yes, I am. I'm rattling my article, actually. A copy of my article. In March 2015 QST, what I have is an article about this in which I have a lot of pictures showing directional watt meters at different locations with different conditions, and it mm-hmm. shows exactly what happens under all these conditions, as if you had a power meter at the antenna, a power meter on both sides of the antenna tuner for each of these cases, and discusses the amount of loss and the amount of reflected power you have for all of these different cases. And I think by looking at the picture, it may be somewhat more meaningful than me throwing numbers out over the podcast.
True.
So
true.
I think, you know, unfortunately, we can't do overheads. I guess I can do overheads here, but the audience can't see them. But if you want to look into this further, March 2015 QST, and it's available on the archive to members, if you don't happen to have an issue at home or in your dentist's office, you may want to take a look at that and add a little bit to this conversation.
Now, as I understand it, then, what you're saying is that, in theory, if your transmission line has sufficiently low loss for a given frequency, the SWR, assuming you could match it, I mean, we're just being theoretical here, the SWR could be sky high and it really wouldn't matter very much. Is that what you're saying?
That's absolutely true. The amount of additional loss due to mismatch is a function of how much loss there was under the match condition. So a very low loss transmission line, typically air dielectric mm-hmm. line such as window line or open wire line, or some of the fancier grades of coax with mostly air in the middle,
uh-huh.
typically have very low loss, and an SWR up to, well, even in the case we talked about it with RG8X on 20 meters, 10 to 1 SWR has a lot of loss, but it's not enough loss so you wouldn't want to use it under, you know, if that's all you had to use.
Yes.
4 decibels is a lot. But with lower loss line, the total loss will be much less. And I don't have the numbers here. They are tabulated in the
Like if you were running LMR 400, something of that nature, some low, very low loss cable.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. In fact, I happen to have some numbers here. The even RG 213, which is the larger RG 8 size military grade cable, instead of a 1.3 dB loss when matched, the loss there would be about 0.79 dB, so considerably less loss, even with a not terribly exotic cable.
No.
And it can get better with lower loss cable.
Well, now, you know how some people obsess over SWR.
I do.
And, I mean, I've known guys who, for example, they get their antenna all tweaked within an inch of its life, and they're still seeing, let's say, a 1.8 to 1 SWR back at the radio, and they're extremely unhappy with it. So every time they operate the radio, in fact, this one individual who shall remain nameless, his radio has an internal antenna tuner, and he's just obsessed. He has the 1.8 SWR of using that tuner every time he operates to get it down to 1-to-1. I mean, does he really need to do that?
Not only does he not need to do that, it may be somewhat detrimental because, like everything else that goes in the line on the transmission path from the radio to the antenna tuner will have some loss.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to look at it carefully. And you could actually measure this with a power meter on the output of it. But comparing it with the antenna tuner bypassed and in line, it might have half a dB of loss. So
no.
By reducing the SWR, things look better at the transmitter, but you actually have less signal reaching the antenna. We measure the loss of antenna tuners, external antenna tuners in the lab when we do product reviews of them.
Yes.
And we measure the input power and the output power under a whole bunch of different conditions, different SWRs, different reactive loads, and so forth. And it's fair to assume that a typical external automatic antenna tuner would have comparable loss to one that's built into your radio. So you can kind of get an idea of what the loss would be. It obviously won't be exact, but just by looking at that. Or try an experiment of even with a 50-ohm load, an antenna tuner will have some loss as it tunes to it because it doesn't know that it's tuning to a 50-ohm load. It goes through the same calculations
right.
and comes up with the same thing. So if you put a dummy load on your radio and put a power meter on it, it should show 1-to-1 SWR. And if you measure the power going out of the radio with the antenna tuner bypassed and then switch the antenna tuner on and measure the power, you can get an idea of how much loss you have for that particular 1-to-1 SWR. And we measure the ones in the lab with the same, with 1-to-1 also. So you can kind of compare and see how that tuner compares with other ones. And then you can say, okay, well, with a 2-to-1, this tuner in the lab got this kind of loss. It's easier than, it's not trivial, it's not impossible, but you have to go through a few gyrations to get a SWR load that you can measure, and then the power meter is going to show forward and reflected power, and you got to go through all kinds of calculations. But so that's why I'm suggesting you make the measurement with a 50-ohm load, and then you don't have to make any corrections. It's easy to measure and tells you everything you need to know.
So, you can see exactly what is happening.
Yeah.
So really, if my friend, the one we were talking about, as long as his radio is putting out the full 100 watts that he prefers into that 1.8 to 1 SWR, he doesn't really need to use the tuner to take it all the way down to his magical flat 1-to-1, correct?
Absolutely correct. Another thing you can verify with that is if he puts a power meter with forward and reflected scales on that load right at the back of the radio, he should see perhaps 120 watts forward and 20 watts reflected. And the difference of those two is what is actually going towards the antenna. So it should be the same 100 watts.
Yes.
Even though there's no antenna tuner there, it gets reflected from the radio because the radio can drive that. So that way he can confirm to himself that it's not costing him anything.
Right, exactly. Now, what about, though, this has always intrigued me when it comes to the topic of SWR, what about the effect of an elevated SWR on the received signal?
That is interesting discussion because of a couple things. One thing is the SWR that you see transmitting is a function of what the antenna load is on the end of the transmission line. In the other case, the antenna is acting at the source, and the SWR is actually the SWR. There's actually two interfaces. One, the antenna driving the transmission line, but the other is the transmission line driving the radio. And just because the radio is spec'd at 50 ohms doesn't mean the input impedance is exactly 50 ohms. So it can be slightly different.
Yes.
If you have a tuner in place, then the line going towards the radio should be matched. I think that's true. Probably some strange set of conditions that would cause that not to be true. In general, it's the same kind of thing, but it can be slightly different in detail. Mm-hmm. So, but as a general rule, it's about the same. And probably can't easily change it going from transmit to receive either. So you're kind of faced with whatever you can do. Now, in some transceivers, particularly the old vacuum tube era, that there was actually a preselector that would tend to maximize the signal coming into the receiver on receive.
We don't
have that control anymore.
No.
And it was in common with the drive, but often you could adjust the drive by increasing the level if it needed to be compensated. So you could kind of have a separate adjustment for each mm-hmm. direction. I guess we can't do that anymore. But most of the time, if everything is reasonably close, it should work reasonably well. And, of course, in HF, it's not quite as big a deal as in VHF. The reason for that is in HF, particularly up through 20 meters, generally speaking, most times of the year and the day, the noise that you get that limits your signal-to-noise ratio is not from inside the radio, but from outside, atmospheric noise
yes.
and local noise. So any losses in the receive path affect the signal and the noise the same amount, and therefore you don't even notice it. The S meter may be slightly lower, but you'll hear the person just as well because you're getting rid of the noise as fast as you are the signal. Now, when you get up to 10 meters, the noise within the radio starts to limit the condition, the signal-to-noise ratio, but only on some very quiet days does that happen.
Yes.
So, and 2 meters, it's a whole different thing, and people spend a lot of time trying to improve the noise figure of the front end of their receiver, which generally results in something that's not exactly matched. So the optimum condition is not the perfect match, but it's the one that gives them the best signal-to-noise ratio. So there's a lot of discussion that can be had on this topic.
Now, in summary then, Joel, can we quit worrying about SWR?
Within limits, yes. And SWR will cause higher loss because of the fact that not only is the voltage vary over the length of the line, the current does too in the opposite places. So that there's another point. If you have a 4-to-1 SWR, the voltage at one point will be the square root of that SWR times the matched voltage. So it'll be twice as high in some mm-hmm. places and half as high as others. Similarly, at the place where the voltage is lowest, the current will be highest, and you'll have a higher current. The reason I mention that is if you have a lightning arrestor in your system, and you have too high an SWR, and the rating of the lightning arrestor is designed for an exactly matched system at that exact power level, you can have enough voltage there that will actually fire the lightning arrestor on speech peaks, for example. And this is not good for the health.
I would love to see that.
Yeah. Well, I think they usually say in the lightning arrestor spec that it's specced for 100 watts at 2-to-1 or 500 mm-hmm. watts at 2-to-1, whatever. So, but look at the spec carefully. This is particularly a problem for people who have, let's say, balanced line arrestors on open wire line that they're using on center-fed ZEPs that can have very high SWRs on some frequencies, and the voltage can be very high. Now, it doesn't mean it will be high at the place in the line that the arrestor is, but if you're using it on multiple bands, it'll be a different place on each band, so chances are you can find a band where you can have problems. So it's good to calculate exactly what's going to happen there, and what I've done is actually getting a higher power-rated lightning arrestor than my amplifier calls for, just because I know I will be using a line with a high standing wave ratio.
So is it fair to say, at least, I mean, okay, we can't not worry completely, but at least for HF applications, as long as my transceiver is putting out the amount of power that I desire, the SWR doesn't mean a heck of a lot. Would that be fair?
That's fair. The losses will go up, but they don't go up very fast for reasonably low SWR, by which I mean, let's say, 3-to-1, something like that. Mm-hmm. But again, probably you want to have less than 2-to-1 for your transmitter, depending on the design. Some transceivers didn't do that. The early Tentec radios, for example, were just current limited. If you had too much amplifier current because of a high standing wave ratio that happened to draw a lot of current at the output port, it would shut down the power supply. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I guess that's a limit, but it didn't do it a little at a time like the modern radios do when you suddenly notice, my power is only 60 watts and wonder what you did wrong. And that can happen even under 2-to-1 I've seen in some radios.
Yeah, okay, very good. All right, Joel, we have a question. This one from Ted, KA2BIG, and he's asking, is there any periodic maintenance that you would recommend for old antennas? Things you should do yearly or every few years. He says, I had one ham from the south tell me he replaces all of his coax every year. I think that's a bit extreme, and I agree with him. But how often should it be replaced? Are there any signs to look for before replacing it?
Okay, well, that's a good question. And I agree that coax, good quality coax should last. And I've actually asked coax manufacturers this. Of course, they have slightly different objectives than I would. And they'd like to sell coax, and I'd like to keep coax. But I've heard numbers like 10 years, typically. Now, obviously, it will depend a lot on the environment, because what happens to coax is it does degrade over time, mainly due to its environment. A couple things happen. The outer jacket, while generally waterproof, is not perfectly waterproof, mm-hmm. and you will get some migration of moisture through the jacket, and that tends to corrode the shield. It also tends to migrate into the dielectric. Particularly the foam types are not solid, and moisture can migrate through it.
Yes.
And as shields get corroded, even though the resistance from the end-to-end DC resistance will still look good, the shielding will not work as well if the individual strands are not in good contact with each other. And I think corrosion can help that to degrade. So, unfortunately, it's very hard to see that happening without cutting the cable, and then you sort of have to replace it anyway. So the best way to tell, I think, is to observe the attenuation of the cable. And the best way to do that is just take a power meter and a dummy load and put it on the end of the cable and drive it with your transmitter and see what you get out.
That's what I do.
And it's important to do that when you first install it.
Yes.
And write that down in your
write
log.
Write that down, make a note. Yes.
So you have it on the record that. And that's your baseline. Because, as we noted, even with matched cable, in the case of 20 meters, we had a 1.3 decibel loss. We only got 74 watts out at the end. Well, it's not going to get any better than that. If you go out there and hadn't measured it when you put it in, you said, I'm only getting 74 watts out. I must have a problem. That would lead you to the wrong conclusion. So you want to have a baseline, and then each year or so measure it and see what's happening. And it'll degrade slowly. And it's in that sense, it's kind of tough because you don't notice anything dramatic happening. Things mm-hmm. are just not quite as good. And you say, conditions are not quite as good this year. Well, maybe your coax is not quite as good this year. So it's good to measure it. If you can't measure it directly because the other end is up on top of a tower or something, there are other things you can do. One is you should, every time you put up an antenna, you should take a baseline measurement of all the standing wave ratio on all frequencies that you're planning to use the antenna, and sometimes even on other frequencies that you might want to use as a reference, as we'll discuss in a moment. If the standing wave ratio gets better over time, that indicates additional coax loss. Why
yes.
is that? Because standing wave ratio looks at the forward power and the reflected power, or equivalent. And if there's loss in the cable, the power reaching the antenna is less than it was when you first installed it, and the power that's reflected is less than
yes.
by twice because it's going up and back. So the standing wave ratio looks better. You say, my antenna's getting better every year. Well, no. What's happening is your coax is getting lossier every year. And you can actually, if you know or you took measurements with an antenna analyzer and you know what the impedance of the antenna is by using TLW software or something to determine the antenna impedance, you can actually use TLW to determine exactly how much attenuation the new impedance has. In fact, another thing you can do is if you have an antenna that has a DC short feed, by which mm-hmm. I mean a T-match or a gamma match, not all gamma matches, some of them have capacitors in them, but a plumber's delight gamma match or a hairpin match that should have a short at
yes.
DC, if you measure the standing wave ratio at a frequency that the antenna is not resonant at, it should look pretty much like a short, particularly at lower frequencies. And that should have an SWR of almost infinity,
mm-hmm.
because all the power should be reflected. And, of course, it won't have quite that because some of the power will be lost going up and back in the transmission line. But if you measure the standing wave ratio at frequencies, keep a record of them. If it's a 20-meter beam, measure it at 10 megahertz or 5 megahertz. See what the SWR is and keep track of that. It should show up fairly quickly there that you have a lot of loss.
What about coax that is buried? Maybe not its entire length. I mean, in my own home station, my coax in getting to the antenna, there's about a 10, 12-foot section that goes under my lawn to a depth of about 6 inches. What about those situations?
Well, for that kind of application, I recommend direct burial rated coax, which is slightly more expensive and has a more rugged outer jacket. Otherwise, it's the same as the other stuff. And having it underground will result in additional abrasion, additional exposure to moisture in contact with it, and it will tend to accelerate the deterioration. So it just means you it might not last as long, but direct burial cable is better. Some people say, oh, if I have regular coax, I'll just put it in PVC conduit or something to protect it from the ground. And that's actually not a good idea, generally, because what the conduit does is you can actually get condensation. You actually can end up with conduit with coax in it that is filled with water.
The coax is effectively underwater.
Underwater. Direct burial cable does not mean underwater cable. There is submarine cable sold. They use it transatlantic and so forth. It is very expensive, and it has a lot more around it than the normal plastic jacket that we're used to.
That wouldn't be practical for my home station.
No, it wouldn't. But what you can do with the conduit, I think, and have it work is a couple things. One is if you can find perforated conduit so the water can drain out. And if you have good sandy soil, that may be all you need. If not, you may want to put some sand and gravel along the path so that the water can escape. And that way you protect the coax from abrasion and even animals eating it. There are occasional rodent bites on buried cables. We had that problem. I used to look at strange things that could happen to Minuteman missile sites that had, some of them had buried MF antennas, and we postulated different things that could reduce their usability. But spent a lot of time studying the effects of gophers on buried antennas. But nonetheless, if you keep the water away from them, it'll work just fine. The other way to do it is if you can put a pitch to it so it has a constant pitch and it all the water runs out to one end, and you put a bucket there full of sand and gravel and holes in the bottom, presumably the water can drain out at one end.
Mm-hmm.
So any of those things can be used for buried coax. And but the best thing is just direct burial rated coax in dirt is the best thing you can do. That's the best plan.
So Ted's friend who is replacing his coax every year, Ted doesn't need to follow his example.
No, I think that friend may work for a cable company. Or, you know, it could be he has access to free cable. I mean, that would be a reason for doing
still,
that.
Still, every year.
That does seem a little excessive.
Yes, it does. Well,
10 years might be good. I have some that's lasted much longer than that. Now, I don't know if it still works or not, but it's still there. I still put signals into it.
10 years works for me.
Yeah, 10 years sounds like a good thing. Now, obviously, it depends. That's sort of an average level. If you are in very hot weather in which the heat and humidity is acting upon the outer jacket and you have a lot of moisture in the air, you know, it may not last as long. But test it and find out what's happening, and then you'll know.
Good idea. Thank you, Joel.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.